I would go on to n equals 4, super Yang Mills. And the new thing here, I guess, is S duality, or all of Montanan duality. But writing up these lectures, I have a sinking feeling that I'll probably not get to these last two parts here. But I'll try. We'll see. So, and maybe I should say just a word about how this works. The nature of this subject is slightly different from a lot of physics you might have been used to or have seen in courses and so forth, in the sense that it's not going to be sort of a straightforward deductive process. We'll have a set of constraints from things like normal normalization theorems and other exact statements that you can say. But the essential problem that we'll be facing is that we're going to have to be dealing with a strongly coupled system, like QCD, but a supersymmetric version of it. And we'll have a good description in the ultraviolet, where it will be weakly coupled, and we have a microscopic Lagrangian description. But we want to know what's happening at long wavelengths. And in between is where all the strong coupling dynamics has. And we don't know how to solve this directly. So what we do is we take a page from the condensed matter world, and we guess what the light degrees of freedom in an effective description of the dynamics will be. So in QCD, it would be like we see the quark and gluon Lagrangian, and we guess that they're going to be light pions in the infrared. Where this guess comes from is not always completely clear. And then we say, knowing everything we know about the symmetries and the constraints from the symmetries, things like non-renormalization theorems, we try to write down the most general low energy effective action. And there's some guesses involved. And then we find some way of checking it, making sure it's self-consistent. Okay? So the whole, there's this unavoidable step of guessing in this. And then you find, and then you check for self-consistency. And if you have enough self-consistency checks, you become convinced that you're doing the right thing. Okay? So that's the nature of these arguments. So if there are no questions, I'll just get started. So the first subject are these non-renormalization theorems. Let me just give you a little sub-outline of what I intend to do here. First, I'll do a very quick review of n equals 1 supersymmetry. You need to stop me if I'm saying things that are unfamiliar to you here so that we can... yeah? No, I'm not going to use any lattice techniques. Of course, this strong coupling problem in principle, you could try to solve directly by simulating the theory on a lattice. But in practice, for supersymmetric theories, this will turn out to be a very difficult thing to do. The problem is that the lattice supersymmetry, when you put the theory on the lattice, supersymmetry is broken, along with other space-time symmetries, like rotational invariance. But whereas you're used to in the lattice simulation that as you flow to the infrared, as you go to long distances, the rotational invariance of the theory is restored. That's not at all guaranteed about the supersymmetry of the theory. So you try to make a lattice version of supersymmetry. And typically, when you take the lattice spacing small, you don't arrive at a supersymmetric theory. You flow off to some non-supersymmetric theory. And you have to do very fine tunings of the theory in the ultraviolet to stay supersymmetric. And it makes it basically... there are some ideas for getting around this, but it makes it basically practically impossible at the moment to do interesting simulations of these theories on the lattice. So this will be a different set of techniques. Like I said, it's a funny self-consistency thing where you guess the low energy action and then you use the constraints from the symmetries to find a consistent solution that sort of jumps over the hard part of the detailed dynamics. And of course, it doesn't, and what you find as a result will be some exact results at low energy, but not for everything in the theory, just some limited results about the dynamics of the theory. Okay. I should say this set of techniques, I'm applying them in four-dimensional supersymmetric gauge theories. They apply and work with similar success in supersymmetric gauge and gravitational theories in basically all dimensions. Okay. So this is, I'm just giving here the most familiar examples. And I also, especially this part and this part, will be useful for other lectures. There'll be lectures in the context of the ADS-CFT correspondence where the CFT side is going to be theories like this or like this. I think you've already heard some lectures on ADS-CFT, so, well, you may have heard some stuff already about N equals 4 super Yang. No, but these lecture notes will be copied and made available to you. So maybe this afternoon, or I'm not sure exactly. So back to what I'm going to do right now. Quick N equals 1 review. Holomorphy of generalized, of superpotential type terms, or generalized superpotentials. This is just a selection rule from N equals 1 supersymmetry. Then I'll talk about the non-renormalization theorem for chiral superfields. Then I want to do the same thing for vector superfields, so I'll do a brief review of some semi-classical aspects of gauge theories, Yang-Mills theories, and then I will do the non-renormalization theorem for vector superfields, and then we'll be in a position to do a quick application for finding conformal field theories. Using these results, this is this argument of Lee and Strassler from 10 years ago. And I'll say that in this broad review, I'm going to mostly illustrate it with N equals 1 super QCD just for definiteness, just so that we have a Lagrangian to be working with, so to speak. Okay? So, a very quick N equals 1 reminder. And if there's something that's unfamiliar or that hasn't been covered in Eric's lectures last week, please speak up. So, a chiral superfield. Yep. Sure. Keep on reminding me, because I'm going to lapse into. So a chiral superfield, more or less, depends on only half the Grassmann coordinates, you know, the details, I hope. And its leading component is a complex scalar, and the next one is a Weyl spinner, and there's some other things, like F term, so forth, higher derivative stuff. And chiral means that it's annihilated by the D bars. Then there's the vector superfield. This is just a general real superfield. It has a gauge invariance, though. And if you go to Wessimino gauge, the leading terms are something like this. A real gauge field, A mu, and then the gaugeino. This. And then there's the field, there's the chiral field strength superfield. Here we don't have to gauge fix. The leading term is just the gaugeino. And the next term is the is the gauge field strength, F mu nu, plus B terms and all that sort of stuff. So what is this F mu nu in terms of A mu? It's the usual gauge field strength, well, I guess there's a 1/2 in here or something, plus I times the dual field strength. So it's something in kind of the Minkowski self-dual field strength, where maybe I should say, right, the dual field strength in Minkowski space is 1/2 epsilon mu nu rho sigma F rho sigma, right? Okay. So it kind of makes a complex combination out of these guys, and it's this complex field. And of course, in the anti-chiral version, the complex conjugate would be the lambda bar and just bar. Okay? Good. So it's convenient in supersymmetric theories, especially, to write things in terms, Lagrangians in terms of this field strength. And so, for instance, the gauge kinetic term would be written, here's the traditional, I guess, normalization. This F mu nu times this combination plus its complex conjugate, and tau is a complex gauge coupling. In this way of writing it, its real part is the theta angle, the piece that multiplies F twiddle, and the imaginary part is the usual gauge coupling, 1 over g squared. Okay? So if you just plug these in and expand this out, you would just get the usual action. For Yang Mills, you would put a trace in here, right? I think that covers it. Well, there's also the gauge invariance. Which says what? The vector superfield transforms as follows, e to the minus I lambda bar, e to the minus V, e to the plus I lambda, for this is the gauge parameter. It's actually a superfield. And the field strength superfield transforms as this way, similarly, but not with a lambda bar here, with lambdas on both sides. I forgot to say, of course, this field strength superfield is a chiral superfield, right? Annihilated by the D bars, which is something like, I might have gotten this wrong, minus 1/4, doesn't make, it's just a definition, D bar squared of this combination. Okay? I've written everything so that it's appropriate for non-abelian gauge fields. It, of course, the formulas simplify a little bit if you're just dealing with abelian gauge fields. Okay? Because V is the sort of unconstrained superfield, if you like, because of this functional dependence, W is not only obviously automatically chiral, but it satisfies another constraint, which is D alpha W alpha is equal to this, or something like that. Something means I might have gotten a sign wrong. I think this is right. And this is just the Bianchi, this is just the supersymmetric version of the Bianchi identity. Because after all, it's a field strength. It's the field strength that satisfies extra constraints. Okay. No questions? Good. So, well, with this stuff, let's write down M equals 1, super QCD. So, here's the Lagrangian. We write down the Kähler terms, the kinetic terms for some chiral superfields. I'll call these chiral superfields Q. and Q twiddle. So these are just some appropriately gauged covariantized kinetic terms for a bunch of a set of chiral superfields. I'll tell you more about indices and so forth later. And then there's the kinetic term for the gauge bosons, which I just said over there is going to be 1 over 16 pi trace of W alpha squared. Plus its complex conjugate. Okay. And so I have the gauge kinetic term, this kinetic term. This is what I'll call super QCD. We could add in super potential terms for these guys to give some extra potentials. The ones that are the relevant operators, the normalizable operators that you could write down compatible with gauge invariants are just mass terms for the Qs. Yes? Yeah, the bar is just the complex conjugate. The twiddle is a separate field. So the Qs and the Q twiddles are just separate chiral fields. In fact, so let's talk. So I've kind of left off all the gauge indices here. You should ask me if formulas are unclear. I'll tend to lapse and just drop indices where I can get away with it. So let's be a little explicit here. The Q, I, let's, I guess I'm going to put it down. This is a quark chiral superfield. Quark is just the name. These indices I, I'll call the flavor index, goes from 1 to NF, just the number of flavors. They're just different, like up, down, whatever. And A is the color index, goes from 1 to NC, let's say. And it says, which and says that this thing transforms in the fundamental representation of the SUNC gauge group. So I'm going to be writing this for gauge group SUNC. I'll just stick with that for simplicity. Okay. Similarly, the Q twiddles are the I'll call anti-quarks. That's a misnomer, right? But anyway. That's what people call them. So again, I goes from 1 to NF, will be some flavor indices. And I have the color index, but I raised the color index, which says it transforms in the N bar representation, the NC bar representation, where this one transforms in the fundamental, the N representation. And of course, the adjoint field transforms in the gauge field transforms in the adjoint representation of the gauge group, the NC squared minus 1 dimensional representation. So that's the sort of thing that this would have, an upper and a lower gauge index. So it would have NC squared components, but it's traceless. Okay, if you wanted to write it out in gauge components. And so let me just put in, let's say in this term, some gauge indices. So this has a lower A, so it's contracted with an upper of a lower, an upper like this, right? Because if Q is in the fundamental, then Q, its complex conjugate, will be in the fundamental bar. And this says this thing is in some sort of adjoint representation of the of NC. And this is the one that's appropriate. You get it. Same sort of here. The sign change has to do with the fact that one is actually the Hermitian conjugate of the other. Okay. Any questions? Here. So, let's go on to non-renormalization, no, let's go on to the selection rule, or holomorphy of this, of the superpotential terms. So okay. So let's so what is the idea of this selection rule? It's going to constrain for us how parameters in our QCD action can appear in a low energy effective action. As I said, we're going to our general idea will be that we're going to guess some degrees of freedom at low energy, and but we in these theories we have a bunch of parameters that we can change. In this theory, it doesn't look like there are any parameters except for the gauge coupling constant. So let's make this a little more interesting by adding in mass terms. So a mass term would be a superpotential term. By the way, I'll call anything which is just integrated d squared theta, that is to say, cannot be written in a gauge invariant way as integrated d4 theta, as a superpotential term, or sometimes generalized superpotential term. That includes both the regular superpotential and these terms here. Okay? So let's see what theory. What I can do, I can make a gauge invariant out of chiral superfields made out of Q and Q twiddle, right, by just contracting, because one's in the fundamental and one's in the anti-fundamental, I can just contract their gauge indices, and then they have some flavor indices, and I can just put in some complex parameters, a matrix, I guess, MJI, and those are the masses, right? This plus, of course, Hermitian function. Okay, so now I've enlarged my theory a little bit so that I have gauge couplings and also these masses. And so I can ask the question, how, if I wrote down a low energy effective action, how can they depend? One question that we could ask is, how can they depend on these masses and on tau? So this is the sort of question that this non-renormalization theorem is supposed to constrain, or this selection rule is supposed to constrain. So let's guess, just try to write down some general effective action. Well, in effective actions, right, the idea is that it describes the physics at lower energies. Of course, as you integrate out or do the renormalization group flow, you can generate higher derivative terms. But at long wavelengths, the most important contributions are the ones with fewest derivatives. So let's just write down the leading fewest derivative terms. Those come from the Kähler potential. I'll call this KF. And there'll be some fields, some chiral fields in the theory. I don't know. They don't have to be the same as Q. I mean, those are like the quarks. Maybe these are like the pions or something. And it should depend on the parameters that appeared in the ultraviolet action. In this case, the m's and the tau's, and of course, m bars and tau bars. So here is my, I'm just parameterizing my ignorance by writing this down, right? And I can do the same here for the generalized superpotential terms. So I get an effective superpotential. This thing can depend on the phis, but not the phi bars, right? Because it's a superpotential and presumably can depend on all these parameters. And there's also, maybe I'll have some low energy gauge fields in the game as well. So I can write down something for them. Let's see. Some gauge term for these guys, gauge kinetic term for these guys times some general function. Here, that I don't know about. Yeah. again, it's to be supersymmetric, this term has to be chiral, right? Because it's only integrated over half of superspace, so it has to be to be supersymmetric, remember, it has to be annihilated by the d's and the d bars, or the q's and the q bars. I don't know exactly what Eric's notation was. Since this is already a d, this is equivalent to hitting up to space-time derivatives, to hitting this with a d squared. If I hit this term with a d, it will automatically vanish, because I'll have three d's. But so the idea is, if I hit it, I need to make sure that they're annihilated by d bars. So I need the integrand to be annihilated by a d bar. That means to say that it has to be chiral. So I have to make a chiral combination. W's were chiral, phi's are chiral, and any polynomial that I make out of them will be chiral. Right? So that's the idea. Now, there are more complicated combinations I can make out of these fields, not just out of phi's and W twiddles, but out of the W bars and phi bars and higher derivatives, D's and D bars, that will also be chiral. But those will all have more derivatives in them. So when I write this, there's always a plus higher derivative terms. Okay? And they can have a much more complicated structure. Some of them will look chiral like this. Other ones, it has to be worked out. There's actually some quite interesting, unexpected things that start happening in these higher derivative terms, but we won't try to touch on those in these lectures. That's just some new low energy, just like phi, it's just some new low energy, in this case, gauge vector superfield. Okay. So. So now there's the following argument. Let me go back to my microscopic Lagrangian and say, well, tau and m entered into this Lagrangian the same way that chiral superfields did. That is to say, they each appeared only in the tau appears in the d squared theta term, and tau bar in the d squared theta bar term, but there is no tau bar in here. That's tau. You could say tau is just a number, but let's just think of it as a complex parameter for the moment, right? Let it vary. And this is almost by definition, but I can think of tau, if you like, as the lowest component of a chiral superfield. If you like, I can make another Lagrangian. It might not be renormalizable or something, but who cares? Just think of it. Think of this as itself an effective theory at some high scale by thinking of tau itself as a chiral superfield. And then this will also be a supersymmetric theory. So if I thought of tau in this way as a chiral superfield, then, well, this would all be allowed, but these guys would not be allowed, because then I would have had non-anti-chiral fields in the superpotential. Same here. So I learned just from really the assumption that supersymmetry is not broken, as I go down to this effective theory at whatever scale this is, that I can only depend on parameters which only appear in the microscopic theory in the superpotential. They can only appear in the low energy action holomorphically. This is a selection rule. What is not justified? No, thank you. Very good. That's one of the assumptions I'll be making. There are, of course, interesting theories which actually do spontaneously, dynamically break supersymmetry. So you might always have, among the many questions you might have at the back of your mind when you go through arguments like this is, am I sure that supersymmetry didn't break spontaneously when I at low energies in these theories? So in some sense, for the theories that I'll be talking about, I've chosen the ones which we're now confident do not break supersymmetry dynamically. But there are some cases where you might be fooled. Yeah. Tau is just the complexified gauge coupling. Microscopically, it was just theta plus I times 1 over g squared. Yeah, right? If I expanded this out, this would include a term minus 1/4, 1 over 4 g squared, trace f squared, plus theta over 32 pi squared, something like this. I forget what the normalization is. Trace FF twiddle, right? That, just expand this out, pick out the terms that, the field strength terms, components of this guy, and it gives this, right? So I'm choosing a normalization in which I pull the gauge coupling out front, and I don't include it in the field strength. That's why there's no gauge coupling that appears in the kinetic terms. It all appears in front of the in the covariant derivatives. It appears in front of the field strength. To do a canonical normalization, I'd have to rescale my potentials by a factor of g. Okay. So, are there any questions about this this selection rule argument? If, yeah. That's a way of thinking about it. This is like this is just like regular selection rules that you're used to. You know, if you have a theory, let's just do quantum mechanics, it has a Hamiltonian, and it's nice and rotationally invariant. So there's a position operator, and in the potential, it only appears as x dot x. So there's a nice rotational invariance, plus, you know, e squared over 2m, or whatever comes in here. And then you add in a term, ax1, right? Now this breaks rotational invariance, and so when you're trying to figure things out, you know, well, it looks like you've lost rotational invariance. But you can find selection rules by reinterpreting this term in the following way. Think of it, in just rewrite it as in this form, e dot x, e is just a constant. In this case, e is the vector, a zero zero or something like that, right? And now you can say, all I've done is said, I'm thinking of this term as if it were a vector. I've broken the symmetry, but I can restore the symmetry if you like, if thinking that when I do rotations on x, I also have to change these parameters e by rotating them in the usual manner. So what I learn is that from this is that the physical things that I compute in this theory, and as long as there's no spontaneous breaking of rotational symmetry, then they can only depend on the quantity A in rotational invariant combinations made out of this vector V. That's an example that you use all the time, this sort of trick, and we'll use it for broken global symmetries in what follows. In quantum mechanics, this has really nothing to do with quantum mechanics and field theories in general. The only slightly strange thing here is that thinking of these guys as VEVs gave us a selection rule, but here it involved breaking a symmetry, and here it didn't break supersymmetry, just because giving a VEV to the scalar component, the leading component of a chiral superfield, does not break supersymmetry. Okay. So, let's go on to actually use this to, I mean, this alone isn't enough to give us a non-normalization theorem, but together with some other arguments it can. So let's start by just talking about chiral super, a theory just of chiral superfields and see what we have. To make the following argument, I have to use the notion of an R symmetry. I need a certain global symmetry is going to play an important role. It's called an R symmetry of this theory. Did Eric cover R symmetries in his lectures last week? No? OK. I'll do a quick review of R symmetries. So this is just going to be a global internal symmetry of our theory. And for the case of n equals 1 supersymmetry, it will be just a U1 symmetry, very simple. But the funny thing about it is that it does not commute with the supercharges, the Qs of the supersymmetry algebra. That is to say that the Qs transform in a non-trivial representation of this symmetry group. So we have our supercharge Q, and of course its complex conjugate, transforms in a non-trivial representation of the R symmetry. Okay? Now, all we have is one complex Q in n equals 1 supersymmetry. So the only sort of non-trivial group under which the Qs would transform is just a U1 phase rotation. So for n equals 1 supersymmetry, the only interesting R symmetry, the only one that acts non-trivially, is a U1 R symmetry. So it's going to act by a phase rotation. That is to say, under the R symmetry, the Q alpha will go as e to the I some, you know, whatever the parameter is of this global symmetry times Q alpha. And of course, the Q alpha dot will go as e to the, oops. For later convenience, let's make it minus I epsilon for Q alpha. So the other one will go as plus I epsilon. Okay, that's what this symmetry is going to tell us. Oh, in terms of, let's say, the generator of the U1 R symmetry, I'll just call it R, as is traditional. So this would imply that, in terms of the generators, the commutation relations are as follows. Good. Another way of saying this same fact is that the R charge of Q alpha is minus 1 and the R charge of Q bar is plus 1. Okay? So let's try to see what that means about how it acts in our superfield, in our n equals 1 superspace formalism. Well, if you remember, in the superspace realization of the action of Q on fields, it was just given by the derivative of the Grassmann parameter theta, plus some other crap, right? And so if this tells us that if the R charge of Q is minus 1, then we have to assign R charge of theta to be plus 1, right? So, which is the same as saying, well, maybe more to the point, let me write it like this. The R charge of the derivative with respect to theta is minus 1. And what I really want to get at is what R charge to assign to the measure here, the integration d theta. So remembering that Grassmann integration is the same as differentiation, this also says that this is the R charge of each d theta in the measure is minus 1. So let's go back and look here. Oh, well, and I should say, of course, it's the opposite charge for the q bars. So the r charge of d theta bar is going to be plus 1. So this term is a d squared theta, d squared theta bar. So the total R charge of this part is 0. And so for the whole Lagrangian to be invariant under an R symmetry, I would have to demand that the Kähler term also have net R charge 0, so that the whole Lagrangian is R charge 0. But when you go to superpotential or generalized superpotential terms, this guy is going to have R charge minus 2. So for the whole thing to be invariant, I have to have the superpotential to have R charge plus 2. So we learn that the R charge of the Kähler terms are 0, and the R charge of superpotential terms are plus 2 in this normalization. Okay? So I'm going to look for an assignment of charges to the chiral superfields with this, such that if I want it to be a symmetry of my theory, such that the Kähler and generalized superpotential terms have these R charges. Just to spell it out a little bit more, let's say I have a chiral superfield phi, and I assign it some R charge, little r. Well, remembering that phi was a leading component phi plus theta times psi plus so forth, this tells us that the R charge of the leading scalar, or the leading piece in the superfield, is what I called r. But since theta has R charge minus 1, this tells me that the R charge of, if theta has R charge plus 1, right, that the R charge of the next piece is R minus 1. Okay? This is going to be important to keep in mind. So the R charge will, you can, from the R charge of a chiral superfield, you can read off the charge under the global symmetry of the leading term, but the next one is shifted. So we'll have to remember this in seeing later on in gauge theories when we need to know how the charges of the fermions under chiral rotations. Yes? This statement is the statement that there's a symmetry on the theory under which I do phase rotations of phi by e to the I r epsilon phi for arbitrary constant epsilon. Okay? And at the same time, I rotate psi by e to the I r minus 1 epsilon psi alpha. And that this symmetry is a symmetry of the whole Lagrangian of the theory. This business about assigning R charges to the theta is just a bookkeeping device. If I wrote it out in components, this is just a regular U1 symmetry of the theory. Does that answer your question? Okay. Good. There's one other comment which will be important later, which is that the R charge isn't unique in the sense that, let's say I have a U1R symmetry of my theory, and I also have a bunch of other U1 global symmetries which are not R symmetries. What does it mean, not an R symmetry? It means that these guys commute, their generators commute with the Qs. The thetas, if you like, are uncharged under these guys. So in particular, if I assign a charge under a U1 non-R symmetry to theta, all its components will transform in the same way, have the same charge under that symmetry. So if this is an, let's name the generators. These are the generators. If these are the generators of these guys, then I can make a new R symmetry like this. By adding all arbitrary multiples of these U1s to the R symmetry. Okay? And this will also be an R symmetry. So when there are other symmetries in the theory, there's generally an ambiguity on the R, in the R symmetry, and that will actually play an important role in some later discussions. Okay. Any questions about R symmetries? So let's go and let's prove now this non-renormalization theorem for the superpotential. I'm going to give you it's a good argument, but it's probably the quickest possible argument. So it might be not the best way pedagogically to introduce it, but in the interest of time, I'm trying to condense things a little bit. This is a cute argument from that Weinberg, I think, invented. That's the only place I've seen it, in his volume on supersymmetry. Let's now change gears, forget about super QCD. Imagine we just have a theory of chiral superfields. Admittedly, a fairly boring theory, because it just has scalars and spin a half particles, which basically nothing interesting happens with them in four dimensions. So we'll imagine we have our microscopic or UV theory. Since these theories are not, none of them are renormalizable, I'm always going to think in terms of some effective theories at some scale. So this will be my high scale, mu naught. This is just some energy scale, defining scale at which I'm defining my effective theory. And it's going to have a superpotential, which is a function of some set of, let me give it some index, some set of chiral superfields phi. Okay? So the question is, I want to now ask what happens if I flow down in the scale mu, and I'm going to have an effective superpotential W sub mu, right? And now I have to start making some guesses, unless I actually want to do some hard work and try to actually solve the theory. So the question is, effective superpotential at a scale mu less than mu naught, okay? Right? This is what we want to know. So I have to write something down. Let me guess. That it's some function of the same set of chiral superfields. As I said, I need to make some guess about what the field content of the effective theory is, and I'm going to make a simple guess here that it stays the same. I can describe the low energy theory in terms of the same set, or maybe, well, whatever, or at least a subset of the high energy guess. So same set of light degrees of freedom. And this has to be justified at the end of the day. And I'll talk a little bit about it later. So here's a trick for using some arguments to, and especially that selection rule for determining the form of this function. The trick is to introduce a new parameter or coupling, or you can think of it as a new chiral superfield, I'll call it Y, and that multiplies, the only place it appears, it multiplies the superpotential for the whole theory. Okay? Okay? So I'm enlarging the theory by doing this. When Y is equal to 1, or as a chiral superfield, when its VEV is equal to 1, then I'm back at the original theory. So now I claim that this enlarged theory has a U1R symmetry, a very simple one. So if I look at the fields, there's a Y field and a phi N field. And if I just assign charge +2 to Y under the U1R symmetry and 0 to the other guys, then obviously this new superpotential has net charge +2. It doesn't appear anywhere else in the action, so the rest of the action has R charge 0, in other words, the Kähler terms of R charge 0, which is just what we want. Okay? So this is a symmetry. If I thought of this as a chiral superfield, it's a symmetry. If I think of it as a parameter, I'm telling you that this gives a selection rule for how Y as a parameter can enter into the theory, because a non-zero value of Y breaks the U1R symmetry because it transforms explicitly under, right? So, okay. So, what can we say about this theory? This is some unknown function G. G is the function we want to try to find. Well, now I also have, let me call it G twiddle. Now it can also be a function of Y, and we know by our selection rule it can only depend on Y and not Y bar. On the other hand, there's also a selection rule coming from this U1R symmetry. This whole thing has to have charge, it's a superpotential, has to have charge +2 under the U1R symmetry. The only thing with charge +2 is Y. It depends holomorphically. I can't put in Y bars, which would have charge -2 in it. So the only thing I can write that has charge +2 is Y times some function to be determined of the phis. Okay? So I've used a selection rule from supersymmetry and from this broken U1R symmetry, right, to get this. And now I can take Y as a parameter in this enlarged theory. Let Y go to 0. What happens? I have my theory of these chiral superfields. The superpotential gives me my all my relevant interactions. As I set Y to 0, I'm turning the interactions off. It just becomes a free theory. So in the limit that Y goes to 0, or that Y is very small, it's a free theory, and nothing's going to change. That is to say, as I float from here down to here, all I'll get is the canonical scalings of the fields, right? And so if I wanted to do this in detail, we could do perturbation theory and do the UV-IR matching of the flow, at tree level, essentially, because it's a free theory. But it should be obvious, or at least intuitive, that the only way these guys can match is if G of phi is equal to W mu of phi. I said there were the canonical, it depends on how you do your normalization group flow. So up to the canonical scalings, right? You know, the phis with canonical kinetic terms have a scaling dimension 1, mass dimension 1. So as I flow from a scale, high scale mu to a low scale, high scale mu naught to a low scale mu, I'm going to rescale the fields by a ratio of these energy scales, whatever it is, either mu over mu naught or vice versa. Okay? So the net result of this is, now I did this in the limit as Y was small, but it was true for arbitrary small Y. This is how it depends on Y. So now once I figure this out, let me set Y equal to 1, so I'm back in my original theory, and I've learned that W of mu is equal to W of mu naught of the phis. Okay. Now, I know this is a very slick looking argument, but it's actually right. it tells us that the superpotential, under this assumption that I didn't integrate out any fields or form any bound state pairs or new fields, as long as I had the same sort of degrees of freedom at the lower scale mu as at the higher scale, then the superpotential does not get any corrections up to canonical rescalings. Okay. It's certainly consistent with the assumption, but it's not saying very much. There's one place where the assumption is clear. If I took this scale mu to be just slightly below the scale mu naught, well, then I'm just, you know, I'm just doing a small RG flow, and you wouldn't expect that you wouldn't change the field content. So I can use this to deduce that couplings don't flow from this theory, won't flow under the renormalization group. I'll actually make that a little more precise. They do flow, but because we have to take into account wave function renormalization. I'll do that in a second. But that's the gist of it. More generally, since this is just in four dimensions, this is just a theory of scalars and spin a half particles, if it was weakly coupled already at this scale mu naught, we know that it just flows to weaker coupling in the infrared, forgetting supersymmetry, forgetting these selection rules. That's just by computing the sine of the beta function at one loop. So this is the Coleman-Gross theorem of the 1970s. The general thing, Lagrangian, that I can write down of scalars and spin a half particles in four dimensions is infrared free. So that's also consistent with this. And this is this general thing that, assuming that supersymmetry doesn't break, there's really no interesting, there's not much interesting physics in theories of pure chiral superfields. It was crucial that Y appeared holomorphically. That's our supersymmetric selection rule from there. If I was allowed to put Y bars in here, then there are many other terms, depending on Y, that would have net charge plus 2. I could put in here any function I liked of Y bar, right? Arbitrarily complicated function. This, because it's Y times Y bar, this has net charge 0, so the whole function has net charge 0 times y, and this would be fine. But now you'd say, well, what happens in various limits and so forth, right? So supersymmetry played a crucial role. That's what Seiberg calls the power of holomorphy, right? It's just to eliminate this an infinite set of possible counterterms, of terms in the effective theory. So this is not allowed. Okay. Good. Maybe I should say that, again, just to emphasize, this selection rule applied to the superpotential, the one that was a was the generalized superpotential that was just the function just of the chiral superfields, which was the lowest derivative term in an expansion of an effective action. There are, like I said before, there are integrals d squared theta, but there are functions, maybe I should just write it out, of the phis, the phi bars, as well as some of the d's and d bars that you can write down. And even though this doesn't look chiral, if you put the right combinations together, you can make chiral combinations out of these guys. Right. These are higher derivative terms. These will not be constrained by that superselection rule, and so they will be renormalized. So you can, as you generically do in a renormalization group flow, generate higher derivative terms in the effective action. This does not. This only applies to these leading. What happens to the leading terms? It doesn't tell you that nothing else happens in this flow. There's lots of dynamics in this flow. We're just picking out a piece that happens to be, that remains invariant. That's kind of the strength of these arguments. But they only apply to these, to certain leading terms, in this case, the superpotential. There's another piece, the Kähler potential, right? the effective Kähler, the Kähler potential that we find at scale mu, well, it can depend on y and y bar, because it's Kähler potential as well as other stuff. So it can have some general form. We're not going to be able to say that the Kähler potential is not renormalized by this argument. So it, not even the sort of the most important term, the superpotential term, the kind of, in a certain notion of derivative counting, the leading term in the effective action, it satisfies this non-renormalization theorem. But the Kähler term, this kinetic term for the chiral fields don't. No, it's not true. That's what the, so in some sense, the rest of the lectures are going to try to give you an example. This theory is boring, as I said, because it's just scalars and spin a half. But now once we put in gauge fields, then interesting things can happen. They'll be flowing to strong coupling in the infrared. We might have to have, a different set of low energy degrees of freedom. There's not going to be a set way of making that guess. We'll make a guess, and then given that guess, we'll try to use this selection rule and things like this. We'll find quite a complicated set of behaviors happening in the infrared. If this was all there was to the story and it held generally, supersymmetric theories would be very boring. I should say, even in these, of course, you know that there are other interesting, we do know of interesting things that can happen, even in these theories, which is that you can have spontaneous breaking of supersymmetry. That's the O'Rafferty mechanism. I don't know if that was covered in last week's lecture. So, okay, what do I want to do? Oh, I was going to tell you about the wave function renormalization. Given that the Kähler potential can get renormalizations, let's try to actually understand, in terms of the canonical couplings, what this non-renormalization theorem is really telling us about observable couplings. The couplings that appear in the superpotential are not the sort of the canonical strength of interactions or masses that you would measure, right? Because you can, when the kinetic terms in the Kähler potential get renormalized, you get a wave function renormalization, and you have to read off what are the physical masses, you have to rescale the field so that the kinetic term has coefficient 1 in front of it, right? So that's called wave function renormalization. So let's write down the leading terms in this effective action that we've come up with. The leading, I assume that we started with some sort of canonical kinetic term. In the high energy theory, in my effective theory, I'm going to get for some function of the scale, Zn times phi n bar, plus some what would be higher derivative terms. And these unknown functions are not protected by holomorphy, so they're hard to compute in general. And then what did we say we have here? Well, whatever terms were in my superpotential. Let me assume my superpotential was of this form. It was some coupling times some operator, OR. And let's say the operator OR is it's some coupling times some op. It could be a sum of many of these things. A product. This is let's just for simplicity make it some monomial in the chiral superfield, like this. The phi n to the r n product over the n, for some choice of exponents. So this would be some term, in typical term in my superpotential. Okay. So what is the effective superpotential here? Well, phis have dimension 1, mass dimension 1. So phis have mass dimension 1, so the dimension, the scaling dimension of this operator will just be the sum over these exponents rn, right? And so the whole thing is going to scale as an operator of dimension n. And of course, the measure itself, there's a d to the 4x has dimension minus 4, and d phi squared has dimension plus 1, right? You know, the supersymmetry algebra tells us that momenta are like q squared. So phi has half the dimension of x. So if x has mass dimension minus 1, then phi has mass dimension minus a half. D phi, we remember, is the same as the derivative. So d phi has mass dimension plus a half. So d squared phi has mass dimension plus 1. So minus 4 plus 1 is minus 3. So that gives also contributes to the canonical scaling in the usual way. And so we get that the canonical scaling will be this. Okay? This is, I just went through all of this just to tell you what the usual scaling factor is. And the rest of it stayed the same because that's our non-renormalization theorem, right? So okay. Good. Did something with the eraser. So that's our supersymmetric effect of action. Yep. That's a good question. Why isn't the Z a matrix? What's that? Okay. Yeah, but the question is going to be, I picked a basis in which these guys remain the same, right? That's what this argument was. And so when I do the wave function renormalization, it's going to make a difference whether it's going to actually be important for the result. I'm sorry, I don't know. I think well, let's come back to it in a little bit. I don't know the answer off the top of my head, but I think at least to leading order in I think the answer in general, you're right that there will be a general mixing matrix, but it will turn out that to leading order in the couplings lambda, that the mixing, that it will just, it will be diagonal. So the mixing terms are going to be higher order in lambda. That's just in perturbation theory. Okay. Well, let me go on. I'm sorry that I don't know the answer to this. So, assuming it's diagonal, in which case what I'll do will be very simple, but we could certainly carry out what I'm about to do if it was not diagonal. I'm just going to now rescale the fields to canonically normalize the kinetic terms. There was a question? Okay. So I'll rescale. So phi n to some canonical field, which is just going to be root zn times phi n. I'll now rewrite everything in terms of my canonical fields. And so my effective superpotential, pulling out the factors, let me just write this thing out. So this is written now in terms of the canonical fields here. I shouldn't have erased it. This was the product of Rn r to the n. Okay. And now this is now my new, my effective canonical coupling at the scale mu. Okay. So we see that the measured couplings actually do get normalized by these factors that we don't know about. Or that we have to compute by other methods. Let's convert this into a beta function equation. Let's just take the derivative with respect to mu. I'm sorry? Where did this power come from? This is just, sorry. It's just a mistake, I guess. Yep. No, I think this is correct, isn't it? I might have the sign wrong, you're saying. Yeah, I think I have the sign wrong. Okay, so I'll get my the beta function for the couplings will just be taking the derivatives here. So I guess I have to change my signs here. Where gamma n is the usual. And again, now I hope I put my signs correct on this. I hope I got this. Okay, so now I have this renormalization group equation for the canonical coupling in this way. And of course, the problem is it's, I guess, an exact renormalization group equation, except that it doesn't help us. We still have to compute the anomalous dimensions or the wave function renormalizations by other means. I'm worried about the the question about the... mixing of these guys. I'm sorry, I'll think about it. So, well, I should say that if you have more couplings than fields, right, then even though you have these unknown functions in the canonical couplings, you can still get relations among the couplings, right? If you have more couplings than the gamma ends that you have, that are unknown. So it's not that this completely removes the content of these things. Let's see. I'm almost out of time, huh? Let me... let me end with an example. A theory with two chiral superfields. So I've just more or less picked the simplest non-trivial example where something interesting happens. Without breaking supersymmetry. So I'll just take in the ultraviolet, I'll just give it some canonical kinetic term, and a superpotential interaction like this.
Okay.
So classically, let's look for the vacuum of this theory. We do that by extremizing the superpotential. So this gives two equations, right? The phi 1 derivative says that phi 2 is equal to 0, and the phi 2 derivative says that phi 1 phi 2 must be 0. But when phi 2 is equal to 0, this is always 0. So this has a whole space of vacua. A moduli space, which is a space of vacua, which I'll just call M classical. And I'm not going to, phi will also stand for its VEV. This is, say, phi 2 equals 0, phi 1 arbitrary. So if you like, it's just a copy of the complex phi 1 plane. Okay? So we can draw a little picture of this moduli space. And this is kind of parameterized, if you like, by the value of the phi 1 bev. Okay? What's that? No, this is just the name of the moduli space, of the space itself. Okay? But we can ask for the masses, what's the spectrum of the particles at different points on this space of vacua. So this is a whole infinite number of supersymmetric vacua labeled by the value of this phi. We call phi a flat direction. What's its spectrum? Well, since we can perturb phi arbitrarily and there's no restoring potential, right, it must be massless. So everywhere, phi 1 is massless. So it has a massless chiral superfield in the infrared. And for any given value of the VEV in any vacuum here, the superpotential looks like lambda times the VEV of phi times phi squared. So it looks like a mass term for phi. And so phi 2 has a mass squared equal going as lambda phi. That's a complex mass squared. That is to say, let me just get rid of this here. Its actual mass squared is the absolute value, the norm of lambda phi.
Okay.
So So there's a massless guy everywhere, and there's one point, the origin, where there's an phi 2 is massless. No, this, how does it work? I'm sorry, this is the superpotential. This is the mass. Thank you. This is just the mass, not the mass square. Okay? So now,
good, that's classically.
Oh, I should say one other thing that we can compute classically is the Kähler term right, gives rise to a metric on the target space, on the space of vacua, right? So let's say so it induces a metric, I'll call it on this moduli space, I'll call it ds squared sub mu naught to remind us that it's the classical one. And all that it's doing is we're freezing out phi 2, setting it to 0, so it just is the metric induced from this term, right? Which is just the flat metric, d phi 1 bar, d phi 1. I hope this sounds familiar. In any case, it's just a flat metric on this plane, so this picture is even correct metrically. Good. So now do the flow to the infrared, some scale mu less than mu naught. And our non-renormalization theorem says that the superpotentials are the same. And so at the lower scale, the same argument will tell us that the moduli space at the lower scale, which I'll call the quantum corrected moduli space, will also be a copy of the complex plane, just as before. Okay? So that's just at the level of the superpotential for finding the space of vacua. But if we want to find the metric on the space of vacua, we actually also have to understand how the Kähler potential is renormalized. So, in general, I have to actually do a computation to figure out how it's renormalized. So let me just do it at one loop renormalization of the Kähler potential. So what's the idea, right? This has this gives rise to the light particle again is, so I want an effective Kähler potential for the light particle phi, so I can figure out a Kähler metric on the moduli space. So I want to find the effective compute essentially the effective propagator for phi 1 from integrating out phi 2 in loops. Okay? So what does that mean? So if phi 2 is less than, if mu is less than the mass of phi 2, which in turn I'll take to be less than whatever my upper scale is, then I can simply do an integration, right, from the upper scale, my ultraviolet cutoff, down to the mass of phi 2, integrating out all the virtual phi 2s in the loops. Okay? The loop diagrams come from, right, this guy, for the scalar components, right, this gives rise to a phi to the fourth interaction, phi 1 bar, phi 2 bar, taking derivatives. So there's like, there's a phi 2 scalar running in the loop, and then of course, it also gives rise to a Yukawa interaction. Running in the loops, right? So the strength of this coupling will be lambda bar squared, lambda lambda bar. And there's the famous cancellation between these diagrams, so that the leading, we don't actually have quadratic divergences or dependence on the UV scale, but just logarithmic. And so we get that when I renormalize it, I'm going to get some correction to the propagator, which I can rewrite in terms of an effective kinetic term, which looks like this. I'll call it like this. Okay. What I've done here is the logarithm of the masses, the cutoff, the ultraviolet cutoff, and the mass of phi 2. And I just put in phi 1 here because we saw that the mass of phi 2 is proportional to phi 1. So there's also an offset from the lambda in here, but that's unimportant. It's just going to give me an overall rescaling, right? This is a negative here because I know that this is the sign of the beta function here. It's infrared free. So this is my effective Kähler potential, at least at one loop, right? So if lambda gets too large, then I don't believe this computation anymore. Let's see where we believe it, I guess. So we can compute the Kähler metric. So what is that? As usual, you take the Kähler potential, and you take its derivative with respect to phi and phi bar of the Kähler metric, d phi bar. So this is our metric. I assume in Aspinwall's lectures you heard about Kähler geometry and so forth. But this is how the effective coefficient of the kinetic term is just computed from the n equals 1 supersymmetry formalism. So it gives the effective metric on the target space. I'm sorry? I'm not going to rewrite it, but this is the derivative of k with respect to phi 1 and also the derivative with respect to phi 1 bar, d phi 1 bar, just to write a metric down. So you do the calculation here and you get some answer. What is the answer? Up to some constants, minus lambda squared log of phi 1 bar, plus a constant, times d phi 1 bar. So this is some metric on the complex phi 1 space. What geometry does it give you? There's some singularity happening here as phi 1 goes to 0, right? It turns out you can play around with it. It's easy to show that it's just a cusp singularity. So the Kähler term takes that complex plane that we had classically and gives us now this quantum corrected moduli space, which at the origin has this cusp-like singularity. It's at finite distance. And then there's the plane here. So this is the place where phi 2 was becoming massless before. Yeah? No, I know that it's a cusp singularity at finite distance because I just did this calculation here for you. But you're asking, is there a way of doing it without doing this calculation? Well, right. Well, there are examples, especially with Mohr supersymmetry, where the spaces, the form of the moduli spaces is much more rigid than just a general Kähler manifold like it is in n equals 1 supersymmetry. And so in n equals 2, the Coulomb branch will be a rigid special Kähler, or the Higgs branches would be hyper-Kähler. In n equals 4, they're just locally flat manifolds of dimension a multiple of 6. And in those cases, the allowed singularities just determined by the, if you like, the selection rules, the analog of holomorphy here, for the extended supersymmetric theories, tightly constrains the allowed form of these singularities, much like, well, okay. And so that is one way that you can learn about the forms of the singularities without having to do the explicit calculation. But actually, that's a little bit of a cheat, because what happens in those theories is that the Kähler term is are connected by the enlarged supersymmetry to the analog of superpotential type or generalized superpotential type terms. So what's really happening, why those are more rigid geometries, is just because you have non-renormalization theorems which also constrain the form of the Kähler potential. And that's why you can get away with finding these singularities. Now, I think we can probably make an argument based just on first principles that whatever singularity was here had to be at finite distance in the metric space. But why it was a cusp singularity, I don't exactly know. Why it didn't have a finite opening angle, I don't know. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's what this is. This singularity is actually a sign of. The physics, we have a perfectly well-defined theory at a scale mu naught. The physics should be well-defined at all scales, at all finite scales. So really the point is that cut this, there's some distance here where the mass becomes of order mu, which beyond which this calculation really wasn't valid. As we take mu arbitrarily small, the singularity is just a signal, and this is just a general rule, a singularity in the low energy effective action of a well-defined theory is just a signal that you're missing some like degrees of freedom. That you, if you wanted a smooth description, you have to include the phi 2 in your low energy description as well. Okay? And out here, it also breaks down on the other side, right? This, if you go too far out in phi, then this perturbative calculation becomes unreliable. You have to include higher loops and so forth. So, right.
Okay. Well, okay. I think I've gone over,
but next time I'll start in on doing the same sort of thing for gauge theories.